Good morning. Maya Angelou was born in 1928 in St. Louis, Missouri, just east of here, though she was raised mostly in Arkansas. As a teenager, she won a scholarship that sent her to San Francisco to study dance and drama. Early on, she worked jobs of all kinds to support herself and her son, but her love of music, art, poetry, and dance never faded, and it was only a matter of time before she broke through in a big way in her career. Maya Angelou danced with Martha Graham and Alvin Ailey. She recorded albums. She traveled to Egypt and worked as a newspaper editor in Cairo. She taught music and drama in Ghana and returned to the States to work as a leader in the civil rights movement. Upon the publication of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings in 1970, Maya Angelou emerged as one of the most influential voices in American literature, which she remained throughout her life. "A bird doesn't sing because it has an answer," she wrote. "It sings because it has a song." I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we honor Angelou, who passed away last week, by exploring her influence on a couple of local artists. I'd like to start by saying hello to poet Natasha Elskari. Hi, Natasha.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Great. How about you?
I'm well, thank you.
How and where did you first encounter Maya Angelou's work? Tell us that story.
Well, it happened that I was in the library, which was one of my favorite places, and came across one of her books of poetry.
How old are you at this time?
I was 14 at the time, a freshman in high school, and the library was one of my favorite places to go. It was usually pretty empty, with the exception of the librarian. And then I came, I remember looking at her name, saying, "Maya, that sounds like a black name," and picking up the book, and then opening up just a random page and reading it. I don't remember which poem it was, but I remember thinking, this has to be a black woman.
And that was important to you?
It was definitely important to me. I mean, this is 1990. You can imagine this is, you know, the Cosby era, the different world. All these, we're starting to see these amazing positive images finally of African-American, of affluency. And it just, but this was a poem. So these were the words that I grew up hearing my grandmothers and my mothers and aunts, you know, speak about, but in this poetic voice that I'd never heard before. And I was already writing poetry at that time, so it just kind of struck me. And then I found out that she was African-American. I was like, ooh, yum. So then I started asking more, you know, asking people, do you know who this is? Do you know who this is? And like any good adult, they'll feed a child that's curious about something or showing a real interest. And then it was the love affair that never ended.
Do you remember some of those early things people said back to you that really compelled you to move forward in this pursuit?
Things like, oh, yeah, I know her, or, oh, she's good, or, but more so people, like, this was before email, so people would copy a poem and give it to you, or they would mail it to you. You know, it was things like that, or they would slide it to you at church, things that they had seen, or an article. You know, that was a time when people did that. They would cut out articles out of magazines and would give them to you. And so, you know, those kinds of, I don't think I have much of that stuff left, but that was the kind of thing that happened. And then, of course, just reading and reading, and I was a part of speech and debate forensics, and I was like, I have to do these poems. And the debate coach, the speech and debate coach, was like, well, you know, you really have a chance to go far in poetry interpretation. Maybe you should pick something that's a little more mainstream. And I was like,
wow.
but that's not what I love. And I was like, I want to do this. I want to do this. And I had already identified myself as an African-American feminist. You know, I was super excited about standing in that truth. And so we came to a bit of a compromise. And it was so funny because some of the judges' comments would be, why didn't you just do all of Maya Angelou? Why'd you throw in the other stuff? Because, you know, they were concerned about winning, obviously, and so wanted to pick something that would appeal to all the judges, which were never African-American.
That old, by compromising, you can be neither one nor the other sometimes.
Right, right. Yeah. And you know, the wider the better if you are going to have to stand before judges and they have to take in the physical, you know, aspect of it. So it was kind of bold to not only be African-American and female, but also to read African-American female poetry. And one of the requirements was that it had to be published by a major author. And that was the only way that you could do you know, certain poems. And so that was who it was at the time.
How did it affect you to have that judge say to you, you should have just done Maya Angelou?
Well, that was those were the comments that I said, see, to my teacher, see, can I just do all of it now? You know, because it was over and over again. You know, people would say that you have 3 to 5 judges in a round. And after so many competitions, she finally was like, OK, well, let's talk about this third or fourth poem that we're going to put in there. So
as you've grown and developed as both a human being and as a poet, has the way that she, Maya Angelou, has influenced you changed and grown as well?
I think so, because, of course, obviously you grow and other people enter the conversation. You know, now that I'm 38, I realize when you're 14 and 15, I spent a majority of my life fantasizing about conversations that I would have with different people. And so, you know, different people enter the conversation. But what I do think, I still think that her influence is the same in that, you know, as a mother and as an African-American woman who never denied that, you know, as a woman who tried to stay entrenched in her spirituality, that those are all the things that I loved about her, her fearlessness in her writing, her honesty, the vulnerability.
Well, Natasha, I'm going to get to our second guest in the studio in just a moment, but I'd like to hear you read some poetry first. Is there a poem by Maya Angelou or a passage from any of her prose that sticks with you especially that you'd be willing to read for us now?
Yes, I thought I would select a couple of poems that maybe weren't as popular, people maybe didn't know about. And I'm reading from the copy that I actually got.
Yes,
it's from 1986.
Beautifully tattered copy. I love it.
It is totally tattered and smells old, and I love it. And this one is called On Working White Liberals. I don't ask the Foreign Legion or anyone to win my freedom or to fight my battle better than I can. Though there's one thing that I cry for, I believe enough to die for, that is every man's responsibility to man. I'm afraid they'll have to prove first that they'll watch the black man move first, then follow him with faith to kingdom come. This rocky road is not paved for us, so I'll believe in liberals' aid for us when I see a white man load a black man's gun.
Now that is a punch in the gut of a poem. Like, when you read that, especially that last line, as a poet, can you even begin to put words to what that effect is?
No, and that was the power of I think Maya Angelou, especially in the early years. She would kind of like make love to you, then she would punch you. It was like it is like, oh, I wasn't ready for that. But that's what good poetry does. It kind of takes you on a ride, or sometimes it startles or scares you. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of good poetry, Natasha, I'd love to hear you read one of your own poems. And obviously being inspired by Angelou doesn't necessarily mean your work sounds like hers, because you're still you and your voice is your own. So how first would you describe the relationship between your work and Maya Angelou's?
I think other than just the authenticity, I've always been very entrenched in my own expression. And even selecting poems for today, I was like, I can't do that one. Ooh, can't do that one. I probably a little racier, you know, a little more, I won't say outspoken because that's not the word choice, but maybe a little more graphic. And so, but I do have some PG poems. And so I brought them today. I believe in eroticism. It's a huge sensuality. You know, female sexuality is really important to me. So it seeps its way into every single poem that I write. So, you know, I wrote this poem, and I think I chose this one because I do think it kind of echoes, not purposely, a phenomenal woman. And
Phenomenal Woman, that's one of Maya Angelou's
most famous pieces. And, you know, rightfully so. I love that poem. That poem really, well, we can talk about that later. But this one is called The Grapefruit. I savor fruit like I want to be. I gently tear open its flesh, ignoring the sticky streams down my finger. There has been sweeter. A milkshake can do it better. But with fruit, you get something in return. Its complexity of acids. It takes two names to classify me. That be me, looked over, a little too big for a quick snack, run the risk of being bitter, so perspective step back. But If you sit in the sun with me, pull me apart quietly, you'll see there is devourable flesh there. Get your face all sticky with pleasure and give it back to you on the inside. But only if you are brave enough to navigate through intentions, desires, and commitments and go straight to the juice. I am a grapefruit, bittersweet in my truth.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you just heard Natasha Elskari reading from her poem, Grapefruit. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce visual artist Peregrine Honig. Hi, Peregrine.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, did you enjoy listening to Natasha's poem?
I wish I could borrow her voice to say anything I'm going to say next.
Well, listeners familiar with your work might find you a surprising choice to bring on the show, but I'm struck in particular by your minimal but powerful use of text in your work. You have been known to use rhyming couplets, which a lot of people associate with innocence and nursery rhymes, to handle very challenging, very adult material. Could you talk about that?
I would love to. It's interesting that I came upon Maya's work when I was around the same age. I was introduced to Still I Rise when I was in a summer program, and I had only read things that rhymed that were supposed to entertain and sort of charm people, things that were in children's rhymes, and or even like rhyming couplets that were supposed to have kind of a glib ending to them. And I was really lucky enough that when I was in the right after summer into middle school, I was introduced to the poem again. So it really was just the language was so accessible, and I was able to reinforce language as a tactile thing and not really be burdened by a lot of the language that was around me that was political, but also really didactic and confusing because I hadn't lived long enough to understand what those things were.
Yeah, so, lots of abstraction.
Right. So I really have, with my work, trying to get this idea across where something is very approachable and then maybe stings after you get the feeling of what's going on. And I've always loved Maya's work because it's so transcendent. It's beyond language. It's this visual, tactile, effervescent, epic conversation that she really seems to be willing to have with everybody. And I, what an amazing person that we have access to her language. And it, for me too, I was thinking as you were speaking about how wonderful it was that we got to touch the paper and read it. Like our first encounter with her work was not, on a screen, but almost in this more intimate way.
Would you mind talking a little bit about your series Ovubet? It's a long time ago. I'm taking you back.
Okay. I was drawing on paper doilies, and I'm really interested in things that are kind of material that are talk about a lot of things. Lace is for, virgins and whores and brides and death, and wax is similar. Flowers are similar. So I was doing these drawings that were rhyming couplets of 26 girls and them coming into their own sexuality. And they were in a candy box and the image was a drawing. And then the sentence below matched the girl's name. And the sentence separated from the girl was confusing. But when you brought them together, it had a kind of quiet and gray area. Like there are young women who are more sexual than other young women, and this quieter conversation that is not had as often between predator and prey. And it was the language that I came to first with those pieces, and a lot of the stories that I was illustrating with my own language were women that I knew, not necessarily using their names, but A is for Abby, who covered her breasts, B is for Bia, completely depressed. And just you, as a young woman, you don't realize how often you're being watched and how, as a older woman, it's really effective for me to see how I see young women. And I know that they're being watched. And that I'm watching them. And I really love how Maya Angelou talks about how, as young women, like, we watch men and our sexuality is filling our bodies. And at the same time, like, you know, watching women come into who they are going to be for the rest of their lives. You know, it's fantastic.
After Dr. Angelou died, you posted the following stanza from Still I Rise to your Facebook page. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. What is it about those lines that speaks to you?
Oh, good God, the word still.
Me too.
Stillness, just that it is, it's the perception of a word that is so many things, that it is the ability to not move. It is the ability to be stubborn. It is the ability to be a still, something full of something else. And just with that final sentence, it's so impactful, and it's such an embracing way of having people become empowered. And it really doesn't matter who you are, or again, what age you are, or what gender you are. It's just this inclusive way of making you understand that language is powerful and can move you from the inside out, from the outside in.
Natasha, I wonder if you'd weigh in on this use of the word still in this poem, Still I Rise.
Definitely. I think about despite, yet, which to me speaks directly to the origin of my people in this country. You know, everything, we were not expected to survive. The fact that we are here still is a miracle.
So still as despite, yet as endurance.
Yes. And then, of course, like my sister here was saying, the double entendre of stillness, which spiritually is very powerful, and something that I had to grow into. On Sunday, I was asked to read this poem in church, and this Still I Rise was one of the poems that I did for competition. And I remember every time I would do it, it would give me chills, you know.
Do you remember where in the poem you would feel those chills?
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. Yeah, that is so true. It's still true.
Are those words that ring out in your mind at various occasions in your own life? Do you hear her language as you move through the world?
I hear my ancestors' language and movement. I really feel very strongly connected to my ancestors, and now she's one of them. So I may hear her a lot more than I did before, as she walked on this plane. Yes, and I think I, you know, Maya Angelou for me is just an extension of all of the women that I know that maybe didn't have the voice that she had. So she was just a manifestation of what I've always known. And I think when you can connect with an artist that way, that is so powerful. When you're like, she was in my journal.
Yeah, Peregrine, do you ever feel that with her, with lines of Maya Angelou's work?
Yeah, and just the way that you have as a visual, very visual person, this is something so subtle. But for me, you know, I have the same book. It's like this is this tattered book that you are traveling, you know, and you see somebody on the subway with that book, and it's you feel that the person who you are connected to, or that you've had the same experience as the person who has read her words, because she's so impactful, and it's such like a soft and beautiful chain that she makes with her words. And so, do I hear her? Do I feel her in the future? Would I give her words to anybody else as a gift? I felt I was gifted to run into her work, or to be asked to explore her work, when I was really the same age. I think I was like 14 years old. And I'm so glad that she's been celebrated and honored, and will continue to be a part, hopefully, of curriculum or international curriculum, because I think that she's a very important, intelligent, well-spoken human being.
Peregrine, we talked a little bit about double entendre, especially in this poem, Still I Rise. Can you talk a little bit about the use of double meaning in and wordplay in your own work?
Yeah. I love things that happen in language. I was playing with Rapunzel a couple of years ago and realized that fortresses can be used to make people get confused if you made a mistake when you were writing, because I have nice handwriting, so it's fun for me to play with line that way. And also, there are so many words in the English language like exploit and exploit that really it's nothing but an inflection that makes some difference, but they're so incredibly different, you know? Or there are words that are spelled differently, like chaste and chaste, which are about, again, similar but different things, like to chase somebody or to hold back, to be even virginal in the more, you know, conservative version of that word. But the really great thing about words is that it is what you're reading, but it's also how you come to them. So when you're reading something by Maya, there's this moment where you can read it with 3 minutes in between it, and what it means to you 3 minutes later is going to be different based on how you feel about words.
Yes, I totally agree. And that is the part as a writer that you obsess about, how you're coming across. And I don't know much about her writing process, but I know that her words are so carefully placed mm-hmm. and selected. She just doesn't waste language.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, whether her poems are longer or shorter, the selection of her words and the placement, to me, I love simplistic language to evoke powerful meaning. I'm not interested in the 14-letter words. Mm-hmm. I'm intrigued by them, and it excites me when I'm reading essays. But for poetry, it's like, how many 3-letter words can I use to convey this meaning?
Natasha, do you have another poem by Maya Angelou that might illustrate that point for us?
Yes, I do. I want to talk about Peregrine.
Yeah.
Peregrine. I need to write that because that's how I have to. She was talking about being watched, being a young woman and being watched. And I remember reading this poem when I was 14. And I said, this woman has
got it. Yeah,
she got it. And I wrote a selection of poems called Music, Men, and Me for my international baccalaureate exam in theater. And this poem inspired some of those poems, and it's called Men. When I was young, I used to watch behind the curtains as men walked up and down the street. Wino men, old men, young men sharp as mustard. See them? Men are always going somewhere. They knew I was there, 15 years old and starving for them. Under my window, they would pause, their shoulders high like the breasts of a young girl, jacket tails slapping over those behinds. Men. One day, they hold you in the palm of their hands, gentle, as if you were the last raw egg in the world. Then they tighten up, just a little. The first squeeze is nice, a quick hug, soft into your defenselessness. A little more, the hurt begins. Wrench out a smile that slides around the fear. When the air disappears, your mind pops, exploding fiercely, briefly, like the head of a kitchen match, shattered. It is your juice that runs down their legs, staining their shoes. When the earth rights itself again and taste tries to return to the tongue, your body has slammed shut. Forever. No keys exist. Then the window draws full upon your mind. There, just beyond the sway of curtains, men walk, knowing something, going someplace. But this time, you will simply stand and watch. Maybe.
Ooh, that last maybe. Will you talk about that last maybe?
I think once the, I think fantasy is one of the best places to live. And I think when the fantasy of lovemaking is broken, until you get a better situation, it probably feels like this. I think this feels like this for a lot of women. Their first time, their first 20 times, 30, 40, 50 times.
Natasha, I want to ask you something from more of a poetic place. I mean, not from more of a place of talking about language and identity as a poet. I heard an interview with Maya Angelou on Studio 360 where she was talking about that she was a Black woman and that that was a very particular experience, but that in order to communicate, she must also be a Jewish man and an Asian woman and so forth. What do you think is the interplay between a specific kind of lived experience and a universal truth?
Well, we are all spiritual beings inhabiting the physical form. And I think that is what she was trying to convey to us. And that a part of being African-American and being woman is being human and being able to convey that so that it can impact a person. Once I did a reading and a gay white man came up to me and said, you just touched my inner Black woman. And I thought that was the funniest and best compliment ever, because what it said to me was, we have very little between us that is the same, but your words touch my heart. And I think that is what art, to me, that is what art is about. Can I write specifically about my experience as an African-American woman to evoke a human emotion in anyone? And that's when you know that you've hit that ding.
Peregrine, what are your thoughts about that?
There's like that abbreviation, keep it simple, stupid, you know, KISS. Are we creative beings in the universe doing things and affecting people as we make our stuff and do whatever weird thing that it is that we have to do? I feel like we are watching the world become hopefully so much more open-minded and open-eyed about the different ways that people are and being compassionate towards them for who they are and celebrating them. I was really excited to see Laverne Cox on the cover of Time magazine because...
Maybe explain quickly who that is.
A transgendered activist.
Yeah, and a beautiful, dynamic, intelligent, hardworking person who is being celebrated for her grace and beauty and presentation of herself in America. And I think everybody is broken in one way or another. Everyone is ashamed for one reason or another, and it is about class, and it is about race, and it is about gender, and it is about how you are perceived by other people. And I'm so glad that we're living in a time where we have so many different kinds of people that are being considered as intelligent leaders of the future.
Well, we are going to get back to this exciting conversation after a very short break. Central Standard will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Hope you'll return in just a couple minutes with us. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. If you were just listening a few moments ago, you know that we are talking with Natasha Elskari, a poet in Kansas City, and Peregrine Honig, a visual artist, about memories of Maya Angelou and the way that her work is with them still. And we'd like to hear from you as well, your remembrances and the words of Maya Angelou that stick with you and maybe affect you in your life. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join that conversation. The number again is 816-235-2888. And we were just talking about that interplay between a specific lived experience, you know, the ways that other people see you and categorize you, and then a universal kind of truth that you might want to explore in your art, or if you are an artist that you almost definitely want to explore in your art. Peregrine, could you talk a little bit about where your own comfort zone is when it comes to being a woman who explores sometimes gender in your work, but maybe not necessarily wanting to be pigeonholed as a woman artist?
I have this one image that I made for a piece that I printed with Lawrence Lithography, and it's an image of this bear, and he's holding this young woman, and the title is Bareback, kind of as a pun on that word. And then the rhyming couplet is, Goldilocks, Goldilocks, what were you thinking looking for love when you'd been drinking? And I always show it at when I give a talk at a lecture at a college. I think it's, everybody laughs. It's kind of entertaining. And I really want to be affiliated with women that are amazing artists and writers and performers. But I really want in my life is I really want to be affiliated and connected to just people who are amazing writers and artists and performers. And so for me, I don't speak about my work from the standpoint of being a feminist. I speak about my work from the standpoint of being a human being. And for me, and it's a personal choice, I avoid being in all women's shows because I don't work hard to be in all men's shows. I just want to show with other people. And if I can even project onto somebody as incredible as Maya Angelou, I don't believe that Maya's intention was to be celebrated as a Black feminist American artist, but as a human being. Like, I bet that what she pushed for was for inclusion. And I identify with her as a woman, and I am an American, and I'm proud to be any part of anything that she would call herself. In terms of my work and what I am, how language is applied to me, it's interesting how language can also, it can cage you. And so it's amazing that we can talk about our work and have the freedom to decide how we're going to express ourselves and how we want to do those things.
Natasha, how do you navigate that territory?
Probably a little different, yeah. I think, than my sister here. And that is because I feel that if I don't tell my story, surely someone else will. And the story that is being told of African-American women is reality TV. Yep. And by God, that is not that is not our story. That is specifically not my story. And I feel very solid in my body and myself as an African-American woman, as a mother, as a daughter, as having working class roots, as valuing education. Like, all of these layers make up who I am, and I wear them into the world to be a human being, but I never steer far from them. I do not sit down and say, I am going to write a Black feminist political piece. I don't do that. But because I am an African-American feminist, it is in my work. And I don't know how Maya Angelou titled herself. But I was talking with a friend yesterday, and they were talking about, well, Maya Angelou, as a Christian, how do you feel about X, Y, and Z? And she said, I hear people say, as a Christian, and she's like, I'm just trying to be. I don't ever profess to be that. So I think that she probably did do some defying of particular groups. But that is not confining to me. I guess there's a part of me that likes to feel a part of community. And it has allowed me to go anywhere. I am comfortable in any setting because I know exactly who I am. And so it gives me the ability to talk with someone from a completely different background and perspective because I get to be exactly who I am and I allow them to be exactly who they are. And that's how we can start to talk about the change and the truth of what is happening.
Maya Angelou wrote a book called Letter to My Daughter. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if if that's a book that you've read, and if you read that feeling in some way as her daughter.
Yes, my friend Gustavo Adolfo Ibarra bought that book for me when I graduated from UMKC with my master's degree. And I was laughing. I was like, she doesn't have any daughters. I was like, wow, did I miss something? I thought she only had one son. And but he said, I read this book and I thought this reminded me of you in so many ways, but also that you could get something from it. And again, yes, she talks about these amazing, painful experiences that I think many mothers are afraid to talk to their daughters about and that may have had similar experiences. Like she talks about one of the letters that stands out is when she is receiving an award and she is at some type of movie situation. And she remembers as she is going up to receive the award of how it felt sitting in the segregated section of the theater and how, you know, there were never any black people on screen. And she just was so angry that she couldn't get out any words as she stood up there and she was hot and steaming. And you know how anger comes. And later people wrote that she had been drunk. Oof. And that, you know, and that or that she had abused drugs. And that was why she couldn't properly accept the gift. And so to be able to go back and write, I was angry and hurt because I remembered all the feelings we had when we looked at the silver screen. I mean, are you serious? What a powerful letter to write, you know.
Why is it important to know that your foremothers have experienced hurt and anger and difficulty and frustration?
I think because for me, knowing that someone else survived it is what is the most powerful. And if they didn't survive the exact same thing, that you know that you have in you to survive it. You know you have it. And you can look to these stories and say, they survived it in this time with maybe far less resources. Get off your butt, stop crying, and keep fighting. That's what it does for me.
Well, KCUR's Laura Spencer was one of the last people to interview Maya Angelou, who happened to be scheduled to appear at the Kauffman Foundation for the Performing Arts when news broke that she had died. Although that performance obviously won't be taking place, Laura interviewed Dr. Angelou in anticipation of the event, and I'd like to play a clip from that interview now.
You know, I mean, no person in the world dances every day, sings every day, or plays the violin or the drums every day. But everyone who isn't a mute or hermit uses words. And the writer has to use these most famous elements. She or he has to take some nouns, pronouns, adverbs, adjectives, phrases, and put them together, ball them up, throw them against the wall, and make them bounce. It's no small matter, because when it comes off, oh, it's sweet, and it's right, but oh, getting it right.
Natasha, that was Maya Angelou speaking to Laura Spencer just 2 weeks ago, and you are a poet, so I'm guessing you can relate to this idea of taking words, which everyone uses every day, in all kinds of scenarios, ranging from the very mundane to the exalted, and turning them into something else, something artful, making them bounce, as she says.
Yes, and I thought to myself, revision, 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 revision. And, it's so painful. Revision is so painful. I'm going through that now as I you know, try to work on my manuscript. Yes, and I never thought of it that way. Sometimes when I write, I think, well, what does it matter that I write? You know, everybody is writing something. I remember thinking everyone journaled until one of my friends said, you know, everybody doesn't do that. And I was 8 years old. And I was like, really? Like, you don't go home and write down? No. Who does? Who does that?
But because it's like breathing for you.
Yes.
You thought it was like breathing for everyone.
I did. And maybe my love of language, why I enjoyed listening to the women in the kitchen more than I did playing. I loved hearing people cry or talk as they cry or as they scream or listening to how people use passionate words. So yes, that is so true. Placement, pause, stillness.
Yeah. Peregrine, are you relating to this, your relationship with drawing and lines?
Yeah, for sure. When you realize that everybody isn't going home and doing the weird neurotic thing that you have to do. You know, like just, and yeah, like being a listener and processing things, and I'm sure that you relate to this, but the difference between realizing that a lot of the people that are identifying as like, oh, I'm a writer, or oh, I'm an artist, you know, they're mirroring, they're just sort of copying something. Like, you know, I didn't want to draw unicorns, but, you know, I wanted to do something else, and I needed it to process. It was something that I did to process things. And that's a great line, like, art is the ability to turn material into thought. And what's better material as a girl than sitting in the kitchen and listening to your mother's friends, like, talk about a breakup? I mean, those are things, they're the seeds of what grow to make you understand the world.
Absolutely. I agree. I listened to my daughter. My daughter is 10, and she would fall in love with you, by the way.
Thanks.
And she has the best one-liners. And I'm like, these are poems. You know, she wrote her brother a letter. He had gone away to camp. And she said, I miss you. I want to see you yesterday, but I'll settle for tomorrow.
And how old is she?
This was 2 summers ago, so she was 8.
Whoa.
And I was like, I want to see you yesterday, you know. And I was like, that's a poem, you know. And she says things to me because she grew up around her grandmother. We lived in a multi-generational home for about 6 years. And so she's got all of these old Black women ways, but she's 10. And then she's got this mom who, you know. And so she says these things that are all three of these, you know, generations. And so it is true. You pick up on these things, and she'll always say, I'm not a writer, I'm not a poet. And I said, well, you don't have to be. And she says, because your poetry makes people laugh and my poetry makes people cry. Like, you can be a crying poet too. So maybe I need to do a better job of sitting her down with some sad poetry, but yeah, so it is very interesting when you think about, you know, words. And I am constantly editing, even as I read. I'm like, oh, I don't like that line anymore, or I don't. And that's overwhelming at times. You do have to kill the poem and just let it live. Kill the poem to let it
so
live.
So it can live.
Yes, yes. Because you'll windle it down to nothing. You
yeah.
know?
Natasha, speaking of your daughter, thinking about generations of makers and cultural people and living in the world, what kind of interactions do you have with maybe a next generation of young poets? And do you see them entering a different world than Maya Angelou was in, perhaps because of her?
Oh, definitely. I had the honor and privilege of teaching this academic year with the Writers' Place with Theodore Priest Hughes in an after-school program called Write On. And it was a really, when we talk about diversity, I'm talking about this was a real diverse group of students, 6th through 12th grade, private school, public school, Catholic school, charter school students, across class, race, perceived sexual orientation. I mean, it was really diverse. And we are in good hands. I am not concerned about the future of creativity, writing in the human condition. And I always tell people, if you are concerned, go to young people, because they provide such an awesome and fresh insight, and they are hungry for adults who will listen to them, guide, and not judge them. And that's what I had a chance to do. I have a passion for teaching workshops and things like that. And so it is a different world, because, you know, we type more than we write. And even I am a bit of a hybrid when it comes to those things. And I think for writing, that level of creation is different. A chalkboard versus a dry erase board versus an iPad versus typing on your phone. I mean, I use all of those things, and I think that impacts how poems come. You know, I write poems when I am in between, you know, practice and driving home, and in the car and in the grocery store. I'll pause in an aisle and type it in, start it in my phone, and then go back, and you know what I mean? So
yeah.
The way that we create, I think, is different. And so I think their poems have a speed to them that maybe in my generation and definitely Dr. Angela's generation, that's completely different. But she's so smooth, you know. I mean, everything is so smooth.
She is so smooth. Is there a short one of her poems that you'd like to read before we go?
Yes. And this one impacted me because I think this is so different from I mean, we've all waited by the telephone at some point, but now waiting by the telephone looks different, doesn't it?
So sure does.
It does, right? Because you can still go out with your girls and hang out and shop and still be waiting for a call. But life is so different. And I was telling my children just the other day, there was a time that if you weren't home, you didn't get the call.
Yeah.
The telephone, it comes in black and blue, indecisive beige, in red, and chaperones my life, sitting like a strict and spinstered aunt, spiked between my needs and need. It tats the day, crocheting other people's lives and neat arrangements, ignoring me, busy with the hemming of strangers, overlong affairs, or the darning of my neighbor's worn-out dreams. From Monday, the morning of the week, through the midtimes, noon and Sunday's dying light, it sits silent. Its needle sound does not transfix my ear or draw my longing to a close. Ring, damn you.
Wow. When did you first read that poem again?
I was 14.
And how did that poem strike you then, and how does it strike you now?
I thought about the phone being an indecisive beige. And I was like, that is so true. Beige is the safest dang on color on the planet. And I was thinking, I want to paint my bathroom beige because I'm afraid of color on the walls. So the idea of being taunted by a telephone not ringing and waiting, anticipation, impatience, we all have to go through that, whether it's waiting for a call for a job or a call for a lover or a call from your child who's out too late, whatever. Ring, damn you, ring, you know.
Well, but for both of you, I want to ask, there's so much that's been said about Maya Angelou, and especially in the last week, there's so much that's been said. Has something gone unsaid? Is there anything that you feel needs to be said that hasn't?
I'm not sure about that, because I don't really watch a lot of television, but I will say that she is a pure, I have not cried for Dr. Angelou because I believe that she is a life well lived. She lived the heck out of her life from start to finish, and she shared her wisdom and her lessons. 86 years on the planet, multiple homes, international travel, love, birth, life, death, partying. One of her best pieces of advice that she gave to my friend was, drink it high quality and drink it slow.
Mindfulness in its own
mindfulness
way.
I hope that whatever it hasn't been said about her is just said into for the rest of the time that we're on this planet. I mean, I hope that nothing, there's never an end to what is said about this woman. So yes, plenty has been unsaid so far. So yeah, I don't think I can trump that beautiful quote about drinking slowly.
And gorgeous. She is widely quoted as far as like these gems of advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? That she's something that is very poet, but it's also something that's very beyond poet.
Don't you wish that we could have had like one last drink with her before
yes.
she left? It'd be really nice.
Definitely.
You know, she's one of those bucket list people. You're like, I can't tell you how many times, like, oh, if you could have a dinner with somebody, who would it be? Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
Yeah. I was going to go with two of my friends to see her next week, and we're still going to get together and celebrate and read her work. That's how we're going to do it.
A high drinks. Quality slow drink.
It probably won't be high quality on our budgets, but it will be drinking going on. But I think, like she said, I think she is a wonderful dodgeball player. She knows how to throw it against the wall and make it hit and stick and punch.
That's
and
revisiting that line about making the words bounce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that is about all the time we have for today's conversation. But I want to thank our guests so profoundly. I know that you're both very busy people. I'd like to thank Natasha Elskari, a poet living here in Kansas City, and artist Peregrine Honig for being here this morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you
for having
Wonderful
us.
Wonderful conversation.
Yeah, it was very fun.
Yes. And we'll have to get both of you together sometime once again.
Please.
You're a great combo.
Thank you. So are you. You're awesome.
You're great.
Go on. To listen back to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Tune in tomorrow to meet Lawrence's smutty metaphor queen. That's Patricia Lockwood. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to go out today with a few parting words from Laura Spencer's recent interview with Maya Angelou.
I'm grateful to have come this far, to be given such a longevity. My producer, one of my producers at Harpo, said if I get 1 million people on the Facebook, that's really good. And as of a few days ago, there were 5,200,000. So that means, what that really means is that my work is of use. And that's a blessing because it keeps me trying to do better and to be better.